Hello, and welcome to the Society for U.S. Intellectual History podcast. My name is Matthew Linton, and I'm a doctoral candidate in history at Brandeis University. This episode, I'm very excited to be joined by Audra J. Wolfe. She's a writer, editor, and historian based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Her first book, Competing with the Soviets, Science, Technology, and the State in Cold War America, was published in 2012 and was awarded the Forum for the History of Sciences in America's Philip J. Pauli Book Prize. Her articles have appeared in both scholarly and more popular venues, including Slate.com, The Guardian, and TheAtlantic.com. She is currently writing a book on the history of science as cultural diplomacy in the Cold War, with the working title of Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. Audra, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I think it makes the most sense to start with the book, Competing with the Soviets, which is really wonderful, and it's great even for people who are unfamiliar with the topic. It's a wonderful introduction. So I was wondering what was the inspiration for this book and also the form that this book took?
It's a great question because it's not quite a standard book. For those people who haven't seen it, it's a short book. It's only about 156 pages, and it's a synthetic work. So it's based on secondary sources instead of primary sources. And I was interested in doing this for a few reasons. I think one of the most important was that as a historian of science and as a historian specifically of the Cold War, I sometimes found it very frustrating when, let's call them more mainstream American historians, didn't seem to know much about the role of science in the Cold War, because it's really pretty essential. But the more I thought about it, I realized that, of course, it wasn't really their fault. Historians of science had written hundreds of articles and monographs and even tradier books here and there about the role of science in the Cold War. But very, very little of this literature was accessible to kind of regular historians. So what I wanted to do was to write a book that would bring some of that literature together, that addressed questions that American historians had been thinking about. So to really to try to tie the story about the role of science in the Cold War into broader stories about changing ideas about the nature of government in the United States, or to a certain extent ideas about conservatives and liberals, or questions about the structure of business and the role of corporations in American society. So I wanted to write a different kind of book that, while certainly conversant with ideas in the history of science and absolutely drawing on that literature, was really asking some different kinds of questions about the role of science in American life.
Yeah, and about the idea of science, or about this book being focused on science, I think you use a kind of interesting definition of what science is and what the parameters of your study are, which is that you kind of include natural and social sciences, but unlike maybe a book that would be thought of as more of a STEM book, it doesn't have the kind of engineering and medicine side. And I was wondering why you chose to include the social sciences but not something like medicine. Kind of, what was the thinking behind that choice?
Well, I would clarify that just a little bit to say that it actually does have quite a bit of engineering in it, although not necessarily identified as such. Because one of the things that happened during this time period was, on the one hand, a lot of talk about separating something that was called pure science from applied science, kind of pretending that there was this notion of completely abstract basic science. But at the same time, there was kind of a almost a smushing of science and technology as separate things. So you might talk about the Apollo project as this giant scientific spectacle when it's really an engineering project, where the same ways that the Manhattan Project, most of the more challenging aspects of the Manhattan Project of making atomic bombs are really engineering questions. So there's a way in which the book really collapses the distinctions between science and technology in a way that's intentional, because the actors were kind of treating them similarly in terms of policy, even though they were using this language of basic science versus applied science. Medicine, that's a more questionable choice, and I think I certainly had my reasons for doing it. Some of them had to do with kind of some writerly instincts about how to bound the project. Some more defensible reasons, besides wanting to finish it and keep it a reasonable length, had to do with the role of patients' rights, which is a huge issue during this time period, particularly in the 60s. you know, medicine operated in a very different way. Kind of the authority of medicine and the authority of doctors was a very different thing in 1945 than it was by the time of the Cold War. And so these issues about what are patients' rights, what are women's rights, were sort of very different than a lot of the issues that I was considering about science in the state. They're related but separate. And then there's also this complication of so much of the debate about medicine during this time period was really about the questions of single-payer healthcare. And that also struck me as related to some of the topics of the book, but so wrapped up with some other issues that weren't necessarily relevant to the rest of the story of science and technology, that it seemed better to set it outside the scope of the book. But it is an arguable question, and certainly a couple of people have asked me about that decision.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting decision to make, but I think it makes sense, especially when you're already dealing with such a massive literature and you're trying to write something that's concise and also something that is trying to speak to some of these larger themes of U.S. history during the Cold War, which also gets to my other kind of question about the framing of the book, which is about the idea of framing it within the Cold War. Because it seems like a lot of the programs that you discuss, especially early in the book, which talks a lot about the atomic bomb, are things that we associate with the period before starting the Cold War, with World War II. And so I wondered why the choice of starting with the Cold War and framing it within the Cold War, as opposed to thinking about maybe a longer period of kind of the U.S. rise to global predominance that starts during World War II.
Right. Well, that's a great question. And one could also take that even further back, because some of the questions about the roles of, say, research laboratories and corporate research laboratories are actually more of a 1920s and 1930s phenomenon. And so there's a different way in which this book could be part of the organizational synthesis and would have started much earlier. So I called it as about the Cold War, but started it in World War II for a few reasons. One is that the scale of projects in World War II really did set a precedent for some of the scale of scientific and technological projects during the Cold War. But one of the things that makes the Cold War different than what had come before was that every time that the United States government had become so deeply involved with the practice of science, in prior cases, it had actually been during wartime. And so one of the things that makes the Cold War different is that these institutions still exist on what is nominally a peacetime setting. Now, obviously, one can debate what it means to call it a peacetime setting during the Cold War. And certainly, the way that the national security state functioned during the Cold War was very different than other times, than kind of other civilian times in American history. But that is one of the things that really makes this period distinctive, are the ways that civilian and military lines really got blurred during the Cold War, during a time when the United States wasn't necessarily actively involved with hot conflicts that were declared. I mean, obviously, there were hot conflicts that the United States was involved with all over the globe, off and on, during this time period, some more explicitly than others. But it was not a, you know, five-year global effort in the same way that it was during World War II, and that was very different to have scientists kind of as permanent employees of government institutions that were involved in scientific research. That was a new phenomenon in peacetime.
And this seems like it's something that would be interesting on the other side of that scope as well, right, which is the end of the Cold War, because now it seems we're always kind of embroiled in some sort of conflict somewhere, and it's the parameters of what are kind of true wars or true conflicts and what are police actions or labeled something else is no longer quite so clear as it was in something like World War II. And I wondered, towards the end of the book, you talk quite a bit about kind of privatization and how that shapes the end of the Cold War science period. And I was wondering what you thought about that kind of as a transition from what is the Cold War to the post-Cold War and the present day about the relationship between science and government. So it seems like, obviously, in terms of the military is still very interested in new technology and also in having a relationship with science. But it seems like that's less in the hands of the universities and other bodies and instead in the hands of private industry. So what role has privatization played in kind of the late Cold War up through now?
Well, I think what you just said really comes close to putting your finger on it, particularly for military research. You know, when we think of Vietnam-era protest and the kind of reforms that happened after Vietnam, where more and more classified research was kind of pushed off campus or pushed onto different kinds of campuses, you know, that didn't mean that scientists stopped doing military research, right? It just meant that they stopped doing military research on campus. And so, you know, particularly by the early 80s, more and more of that research was done in private defense contractors who, generally speaking, didn't have, let's say that they didn't have the most cutting-edge scientist on their payroll in the way that some of the groups involved with military technologies in the 1950s often had fairly, let's see, I'm trying to find the right word for this, where they might have more specialized or scientists who were still more involved in academic research. Scientists who still had kind of an academic presence might do more defense consulting. Now, it tends to be more one or the other. You still have a lot of people with advanced degrees working for defense contractors, but they tend not to do it while on campus, whether that means whether they have a campus appointment or certainly from their campus office. Now, certainly in the 15 years since the global war on terror, we are seeing more of that, but it's very secretive, it's very quiet, and it's very hard for civilians like myself to figure out what's going on. So I think as an outsider, we don't necessarily know a lot about what kind of classified research may be happening on campus today. We know that it is happening, but we might not know much about the scale or what exactly is happening in those labs. But of course, we've also seen privatization in terms of corporate research. With the withdrawal of kind of and basically a blank check for scientific research, which there sort of was for a brief period in the 1960s, universities needed to look for other sources of funding, and they tended to do that from two places. They found it from rising student tuition, and they found it from corporate sponsors.
That's really interesting, and it brings into this discussion the state, which is something we haven't really talked so much about so far, which is, I found that the state played a kind of ambivalent role in the book. In parts of it, you kind of have the state as, if not necessarily a bad guy, something that's maybe compelling scientists to undertake projects that they wouldn't have normally undertaken, or ones that they had moral questions about. Whereas at other points in time, especially once privatization comes in towards the end, you begin to say, like, well, maybe there is some sort of value in having scientists receiving funding from a government body that at least has some sort of democratic accountability as opposed to private organizations that can kind of operate with impunity and don't have that same kind of accountability to the American public. And so when thinking about the role of the state, it's kind of a broad statement, but would you say that the role of the state in science during this Cold War period has a kind of net positive or net negative effect, both in terms of making science kind of accountable to the people, but then also making it so that scientists are able to kind of undertake projects that are meaningful to them? So how do you feel about the role of the state during the Cold War period on balance?
I think that's it's a great question, and I think you're right to pick up on some ambivalence within the book towards the role of the state. And in part, that may be an artifact of the book's reliance on the secondary literature, and I would say that that's not necessarily a strength of the synthetic approach in this particular case. Most of the literature on science in the Cold War kind of originated from a New Left moment that was looking at basically the relationship between university professors in some ways in perpetrating war crimes, really to figure out how a person could be separate from the state's business during a time when most people were becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the state's actions, particularly in Vietnam. And then towards the very end of the book, particularly Chapter 8, which deals with the 1980s and the shift towards more privatization, there, a lot of the literature is really critical of the role of private industry in changing the university. I think what you have in both parts, in both sections, is a literature that's very, very concerned that something bad has happened to the university, that there used to be some kind of moral, stable university that was disrupted and distorted in some way by some kind of major player, whether it was the defense industry, whether it was the national security state, or later whether it's been private industry. And I think there is definitely a sense that something changed in each of those cases, and that in no time period was there a thoughtful enough discussion about what the role of the university should be to the rest of society. And that's really the concern in the 1950s, that while people discussed it a little bit in the late 40s, by the mid-50s, these kind of relationships with military contractors, with defense agencies, had really become a way of life on university campuses, so that there wasn't really any way to talk about it and to think about what might be either in the national interest or in the interest of the university without kind of shutting down the system altogether. And then later you have another, later you have sort of the same thing. Now in 2015, we're finally really looking at what it means that tuition costs went through the roof because both the federal government and state governments were no longer supporting universities, and in part that is a legacy of the end of the Cold War. But it took us a long, long time to get there. And what happened in the interim was that private industry came in and filled the void, and no one liked that either. So that's a complicated way of saying that I think part of what you're hearing in the book is my own reliance on this literature that's trying to make sense of how the university changed during this time period. I mean, my own feelings about it is that I think what I am ultimately looking for in this book is some sense of the public good. That while I certainly don't think that defense contractors paying, or defense agencies basically bankrolling universities is not the way to go, and that's what happened in the 1950s, that there is absolutely some kind of role for the state in ensuring the public good. And it's an irony of the Cold War that that at least in some ways during the height of the Cold War, during a moment of intense anti-communism, it was much easier to defend the role of the state than it is now, because there was a need to demonstrate kind of a gentle capitalism or a kinder capitalism. That goal isn't necessarily something that compels a lot of people to make decisions today. The idea is that kind of markets control themselves and everything will be fine. But, during a period in the 1950s and the 1960s, there really was this sense of a middle way and a sense of the public good. And I think that was also lost at the end of the Cold War. And it's something that people don't like to talk about, because when we think about the role of the Cold War, particularly in the universities, we think about all of these horrible things that happened and all of these classified research and people building bombs on campus. But there really was this sense, too, that the government could accomplish things and that the government needed to accomplish things. And in fact, having the government accomplish things was part of the point of demonstrating that the United States was superior to its opponents in the Cold War battle.
And that would also seem to extend to the university in a lot of ways, too, which was that the university was seen as having this kind of value because it contributed to American efforts, whether they were abroad or whether they were at home. You talk about Great Society programs and things like that. The other part of this is you're talking about responsibility to the American public, but there's also, in the title, Olivia, this idea of competition, there's other publics that are at play here too. And it seems like one of the really interesting parts of the book is the way that the U.S. thinks that it can use scientific superiority as a way of kind of wooing other nations or the people of other nations to their side in the Cold War, or even maybe wooing the Soviet public itself into supporting the United States against the communist totalitarian threat, or however they wanted to bill it. So what kind of role did science play in trying to woo people who were abroad and who may not have had a whole lot of exposure to the United States or to American values, to use a loaded term? So what kind of role did science play in trying to pull those people into the American orbit of the Cold War?
I would say it played a pretty enormous and poorly understood role. I found that chapter on kind of the International Hearts and Minds campaigns, I found myself more interested in that chapter than I had anticipated, so much so that it's really forming the jumping off place for my next project, which is really on this question of how the United States hoped to use ideas about science and scientists for Hearts and Minds campaigns the world over. I would say the chapter on that topic in this book is really still about the science of stuff, or kind of science as stuff. So it's about using scientific products or technical products, or in this case, medical advances. I did make an exception for this chapter. To show the powers of science, and particularly the American way of doing science, to the rest of the world. But in my next book, I'm really going to be looking more about the ideas of science and the idea that there was a particularly American way of doing science that was different than the communist way of doing things. And in fact, that the Soviet communists had a different way of doing things than Chinese communists, and that the Western, particularly the American way of doing science, was better than either of those things. This actually became a really important part of American information campaigns, or propaganda campaigns, if you prefer, during the 50s and 60s. And so I'm still trying to figure out ways to talk about that, and hopefully when I finish that book, we can talk again. But the short answer is that it played a huge role in kind of trying to project the United States as being a reasonable and useful alternative that could help bring these newly independent nations into the modern world, that it could help them build successful, independent economies, that it could raise their standard of living, that it could bring them respect at the international negotiating table, that science was going to be something that would help them do all of those things and more.
That science acted as a kind of great equalizer,
right?
Potentially. It's a really interesting concept, and it's one that I think will be a really exciting next project. So one of the other things, and it's actually great, it's a great segue into talking a little bit about how this book fits not in only into a kind of history of science literature, but also into a history of ideas or an intellectual history of literature, is that one of the things that I kind of kept running across when I first started in graduate school and thought of myself as an intellectual historian and came in with a background in philosophy, but not really a whole lot of knowledge about science. I was pretty surprised to learn kind of not only that, you know, history of science and intellectual history were two very different fields, but also that there were a lot of kind of scientists that didn't really think of themselves as intellectuals and kind of looked at intellectuals as kind of a class that they didn't want to necessarily be associated with. And so I was wondering, as a book that kind of straddles kind of both fields, like what were the kinds of challenges in thinking about an audience for this book that was going to be probably both a history of science audience and then also an intellectual history audience?
Well, see, that's a really funny question. I love it. Because I've written a lot about scientists who wanted to be thought of intellectuals and couldn't get intellectuals to take them seriously because they were scientists. And my dissertation was actually about biologists who had exactly that role. You know, there was a wonderful session at USIH this past October 2015, about the relationship between the history of science and intellectual history. And David Hecht, in particular, had a wonderful list of reasons why it has been hard for these two subdisciplines to talk to one another, even though they have so much in common and they should have so much in common. And he had a lot of very specific and I think very savvy reasons for that being the case. But I think the most important is probably the role of institutions. You know, science, particularly post-war science, is a very expensive enterprise. It's not something that's done as individuals. It's not really something that can be done on a freelance basis. And when we think about intellectual history and the way that we think about intellectual movements, in the history of science, it can be difficult to talk about those things in a way that stays connected to scientific practice, so that intellectual movements end up feeling like a very different thing than the day-to-day actions of science. And I think historiographically, historians of science have really moved toward practice. It's not my own kind of work, but if you look at the majority of talks that you see at the History of Science Society or the kinds of articles that are published in ISIS, the flagship journal for history of science, you see so many pieces that are really focused on what do scientists do on a daily basis? How do they actually take their findings and turn them into ideas? Which is a slightly different project than how do ideas become part of culture, or how do ideas become meaningful, or, you know, it's sort of a slightly different set of questions, and it involves a different kind of collaboration than a lot of the work that we see. I mean, the actors are more involved in collaboration than a lot of the kinds of work that we see in intellectual history. And so it produces some methodological difficulties, right, in terms of how you look at individuals, the role of biography, how you talk about when ideas go into a broader public sphere. Is it popularization or not? And then when you try to flip that backwards and look at how that broader culture is influencing the production of ideas, it also feels... it feels like a slightly different kind of project, but they are intimately related, and I would love to see more interactions between these two fields, because clearly they have so much to say to one another.
It seems, too, that it's a struggle that intellectual history has generally of picking up institutions. Like, there's a kind of blindness towards institutions and a difficulty in connecting institutions and ideas. And there's definitely been some smart attempts in fairly recent years to integrate those two approaches, but it's difficult sometimes to draw a line between, you know, funding on one end and then a book that's produced as a result of that funding on the other. You know, how did that money end up shaping the ideas that went into the book? It is a kind of challenging, it can be a challenging endeavor, but I definitely think I agree with you wholeheartedly that it's one that is certainly worth pursuing. I was actually kind of a little bit curious that you mentioned these biologists that wanted to be intellectuals. So why did these biologists want to be intellectuals anyway?
Well, they considered themselves to be intellectuals. It's just that other historians find it difficult to conceive of them as intellectuals, in my opinion. I mean, when you look at a lot of the hot button issues of the 1950s, you know, one of the biggest ones was race. And so, you know, geneticists and biological anthropologists certainly had a lot to say about race. What race was, what race wasn't, where it came from, what it meant, what was the role of genetics in that, the extent to which people can be changed. All of those are pretty important issues in intellectual culture in the 1950s. And biologists were absolutely participating in that culture. In other cases, you see them participating in that intellectual culture, but somehow being written out of the history of it. This is actually something else that comes up in my next book. When we talk about in the Cold War, one of the groups of intellectuals that was very active on the American side in working with the United States government in anti-communism was the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was a CIA-funded group that was meant to appeal first to European elites to show the possibility of a non-communist left, and later it was very active throughout a lot of the non-aligned world as well, in Latin America too. But, you know, scientists were absolutely involved with that from the very beginning. Almost a quarter of the talks at the Berlin Conference in 1950 were focused on issues of scientific freedom. And yet somehow that doesn't show up in the standard histories of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, or it shows up in passing. It'll say like, oh, you know, and inside there was this geneticist, H.J. Muller, who was there. He was talking about Lysenko, this Soviet geneticist, and then they move on. But this was actually a huge part of these early cultural campaigns that involved New York intellectuals. Scientists were part of that. They considered themselves part of that. But I think for whatever reason, it's been difficult for... some other non-historian of science historians to really conceive of their role in that. I think it's been very difficult to see science as part of culture, and putting scientists into that particular set of intellectuals really does involve taking a leap and saying, okay, I'm going to call science culture. You know, to just say, I'm going to think of it as a kind of culture, I'm going to treat it as a kind of culture, and to realize that they're not necessarily talking about specific scientific ideas, but they're talking about ways that you talk about science. So it becomes a little bit meta, but they are absolutely, they are behaving like intellectuals, they're writing in the places that intellectuals write, they're going to the places that intellectuals go to, they're hanging out with them. I mean, they think of themselves as intellectuals. It's hard for me to think of a reason to not call them intellectuals in that context.
Yeah, and it seems like it would create a very interesting tension, because one of the values that particularly social scientists are always trying to jump on is to say that they're participants in value-free or neutral inquiry, which for them, a lot of cases, seems to mean kind of transcending cultures. And as somebody who looks at East Asia stuff, that's seen as one of the real highlights of a scientific approach to intellectual relationships between American and Chinese or Korean or Japanese scientists, is that they can speak this language that exists kind of beyond culture, and it can transcend these cultural differences. But in fact, you know, these scientists do live in a world outside of the laboratory, and that's a world that frequently includes politics, and it's one that seems like it should be a bigger part of U.S. intellectual history. And I'm glad that you're taking up the challenge of integrating the two fields a little bit better. I think just a couple of brief questions about audience and about the use of this of your previous book, Competing with the Soviets. One thing that jumps out to me about it is that it seems like such a great book for classroom instruction for undergraduates. It explains what can be kind of intimidating or complicated scientific ideas in terms that you don't need any sort of background in those fields to understand. And so I was wondering if somebody was going to use your book for a course on, say, Cold War science, or even something like cultural communication during the Cold War, kind of what are some other readings, fairly accessible readings that you would recommend for somebody who wants to teach this as part of a unit in a class or as part of an entire class on Cold War science?
I think if I were teaching a course like that, and I should be clear for the record that I don't teach, so it is more of a hypothetical question for me than perhaps it might seem. But I think I would want to teach a lot of primary sources where you could really see scientists talking this language. You could do worse than assigning students large segments of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which was a journal that was founded by scientists, by Manhattan Project alumni. But particularly in the 1950s, it really became a venue to talk about what the role of science was, both in American life, but specifically in American politics, and what would be the relationship between science and politics. What was what were appropriate funding mechanisms for science and politics? How could security be handled? What should we do about the Oppenheimer case? What should we do about fallout? Pretty much every issue that came up in terms of science in the state in the 1950s is dealt with in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It's a wonderful, wonderful resource, and it's all on Google Books for free.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I think on that note, it makes a lot of sense to conclude this wonderful interview. Thank you, Audra, for joining us today.
And thanks so much. This was really great.
And please do pick up Audra Wolf's book, Competing with the Soviets. That's out Johns Hopkins University Press. You can also find it on Amazon.com. You can find out more about Audra Wolf from her Twitter page. That's @ColdWarScience, @ColdWarScience. You can also get in touch with me on Twitter @Linton_Matt. That's @Linton, LINTON, _Matt with 2 T's. As always, you should check out the Society for U.S. Intellectual History webpage featuring the award-winning Society for U.S. Intellectual History blog. That's s-usih.org. That's s-usih.org. Thank you for listening, and I hope we'll have a new podcast ready for you soon.